Thank you everyone for coming, and it's a great delight for the Poetry Society to be back at Ledbury. So today we're, kind of launching this year's National Poetry Competition. The leaflets are freshly out and they're at the back. We'll be celebrating the winners who were awarded this year, and we'll also be inviting back a couple of former winners who've also been judges on the competition. And I'm aware in the audience we also have some former winners of the competition also in the audience, and we have one of this year's judges, Kim Moore. So you can nobble her afterwards. So Kim Moore is judging this year's competition with Kai Miller and Mark Waldron. So the National Poetry Competition is one of the UK's oldest poetry competitions. It was started in 1978, and that means it is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. The original judges sort of talk about the time it was, the winter of discontent and rubbish piled up on the streets and political turmoil, and I can't imagine that there's any similarities at all between 1978 and today, but perhaps we are entering the same times, who knows. So the National Poetry Competition, this year we received 13,188 poems. In the last 10 years, the competition has had 117,221 poems. And it never fails to make me realise that, what that actually represents. So 117,000 poems that people have sat and thought about and maybe gestated for years and put aside and then entered. And it's a real privilege, and we love that people send us poems from all over the world. So we're going to hear four readings, and then we'll have a Q&A, a short discussion. There's plenty of chance for you to ask questions if you'd like, or tell us about your experiences of competitions. So I'm going to begin. Unfortunately, we were hoping to have the top three winners of this year's competition, and unfortunately, Momtaza Meri is unable to be with us today. She had a family emergency this morning, and she's not able to join us. So you must look out for her. She's amazing. So hopefully maybe we'll bring her back next year or another time. But we do have the amazing Mary Jean Chan and Dom Berry, who were the winner and runner-up of this year's competition. Mary Jean Chan is a poet, editor, and academic from Hong Kong. She's currently a PhD candidate in creative writing and research associate in poetics at Royal Holloway University of London. She's just had a pamphlet out, A Hurry of English, which is published by Ignition Press. And she's got a selection of work also featuring in Carl Kennett's New Poetry 7, and a collection is forthcoming from Faber in 2019. Dom Berry lives in Devon, where he runs workshops on nature, eco-poetry, and the emotional impact of climate change. Immediately after his stint at Ledbury, he's embarking on a walk. He will be walking to the south coast from Ledbury, so if you have any tips for him on that, I'm sure he'd be glad. He's had poems appearing in Poetry Review, Poetry London, Poetry Ireland Review, Poetry Wales, and Best British Poetry. He won an Eric Gregory Award and also a Gerwood Arvon Mentorship, and he won first prize in the Magma Poetry Competition as well. And both Dom and Mary Jean were the top winners in this year's competition. But because it's the 40th anniversary, we thought it would be nice to also give a little bit more of a sense of the scope of the competition by inviting back two former judges of the competition. Pascal was one of the judges who picked Dom and Mary Jean last year, along with Hannah Lowe and Andrew McMillan. Pascal, you may already have heard her in the festival. She was born in Paris. She lives in Cornwall. And her seventh collection, Mama Amazonica, was published by Blood Axe last year. And it just won the RSL Ondaatje Prize. Her sixth collection, Fauvery, was published by Seren, and it was the fourth of her books to be shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. and five poems from that also won the Manchester Poetry Prize. And then Jo Shapcott is one of a small group who have won the poetry competition twice. Ian Duig is the other recipient of this award, though actually a lot of people have been commended many times or have been first and second and commended with long gaps in between, and a lot of the people who appear in the competition have had a long relationship with the competition, and we might touch on that about when one might enter competitions and when one might not. So Jo won the National Poetry Competition first in 1985 and also in 91. Her latest book of poems, Of Mutability, was published by Faber in 2010. You'll notice that was a while ago. And so she has a new book that will be out soonish. It was shortlisted for the Forward Poetry Prize and won the Costa Prize Book of the Year. She was also awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry in 2011. She's the co-editor with Linda Anderson of a collection of essays about Elizabeth Bishop, and co-editor with Matthew Sweeney of an anthology of contemporary poetry, a wonderful anthology called Emergency Kit. She teaches on the MA in Creative Writing at Royal Holloway, and we'll hear from her last. So, wonderful readers. I'm really looking forward to hearing them read, and we're going to begin, if you'd all welcome, Mary Jean Chan.
Thank you, Judith. I just want to say what an honor it is to be here today, especially reading alongside my PhD supervisor, Jo Shapcott. So thank you. I thought I'd start with a few poems from my pamphlet, A Hurry of English. And this is the title poem. How It Must Be Said. What isn't obvious, because I intend to obfuscate. Oh, choose its own tail like a rabid dog. What does it say about me, this obsession written in a language I never chose? My desires dress themselves in a hurry of English to avoid my mother's gaze. How I typed Shakespeare, then homoeroticism plus Shakespeare into Google, over and over. My mother did not understand the difference between English words, so she let me be. A public history seeps into the body, the way tea leaves soak up the scent of a fridge. An odorless room is not necessarily without trauma. We must interrogate the walls. My skin is yellow because it must. Love is kind because it must. Admit it aloud. So during my high school days in Hong Kong, I was a fencer, and my weapon of choice was the epee. And I never thought I'd write poems about fencing until a mentor of mine sort of inspired me to write about it. And so I'll read two poems about fencing to you. Practice. As a teenager, fencing was the closest thing I knew to desire. All the girls swapping one uniform for another before practice, their white dresses replaced by breeches. I thought we were princes in a fairy tale with a twist, since there were no princesses to be taken, wed. As knights, we were told to aim for an imaginary spot just above our opponent's left breast. Often, I left a bruise, the blade's tip ricocheting off chest guards onto flesh. Just as often, I would feel yellow blooms of ache where the girl I thought was beautiful had pierced my heart. Hours later, I would transform. I would head back home with a deepening sense of dread, my bruises fading to quiet. This next poem is just simply called The Fencer, and it was recently published in the Poetry Review. History. At the age of 13, I wielded a blade because I had a firm grip. I was in love with Shakespeare, and the school team needed an epéist. When my mother flew to Linz, Austria, to watch me go 3-4 down, she gripped the railing until her marriage ring was folded into skin. I wanted to melt my blade. Strategy. You never duel against the same person, even if it is the same person. On the piste, once the blades are tilted upwards, you recalibrate to thwart their every move. She was disarmed by my tears, the sudden time out to breathe through the yellowing bruise on my pale yellow skin. Footwork. Changing into school uniform felt like cross-dressing. I took my time, removing mask, then chest guard, lingering at the breeches. The day I learned to lunge, I began to walk differently, saw distance as a kind of desire. Once, my blade's tip gently touched her wrist. She said it was the perfect move. Attack or defense? My greatest weakness, the riposte. In the changing room, the girl I was about to duel said I smelled of bitter gourd. We were practicing the flesh. Inevitably, I collided with her, a blur of entangled blades. I glimpsed her expression through our mask's steel mesh, her gleaming, smiling upper lip. Grip and point control. French or pistol grip? One offers stability, the other more room for surprise. Before I came out to my parents, I asked myself, French or pistol grip? These days, I thank years of hard work on point control, how two fingers maneuver the blade's tip, a flurry of sickle moons. Since it is currently Pride Month, I thought I'd read two poems celebrating the mundane nature of love. They would have all that. To sing the evening home, she prepares a pot of lentil stew, her phone radiant with messages, imagining her lover's steady hand gripping her smartphone to navigate towards some notion of home, their flat now a familiar place of worship, their bodies growing close and moving apart with the regularity of heartbeat, hot breath. There the lover is, running to catch a bus, wondering at her lover's motions throughout the flat, how her feet must press on the floor with each step, how the orchid must have stretched itself a few millimeters overnight, how the stew must be whispering on the stove and the table set for dinner. They are gentler now because they have memorized each other's fears like daily prayer. How too much salt brings back the years of loneliness. How a bath may be more necessary than a rough kiss after a day's drought of tenderness. They are gentler because they have grown too knowledgeable to love any other way. Have I hurt you? Such asking becomes routine, almost like walking down the aisle of a supermarket at evening, but it is what they do best. Beyond desire, two clasped bodies holding the heart's ache at bay. Conversation with Fantasy Mother. Dear Fantasy Mother, thank you for taking my coming out as calmly as a pond accepts a stone flung suddenly into its depths. You sieved my tears, added an egg, and baked a beautiful cake. You said, "Let us celebrate, for today you are reborn as my beloved." The candles gleamed and the icing was the color of truth, creamy white, coated with the sweetness of sprinkles. We sat together at the table and ate. Afterwards, I returned to my room and touched all the forbidden parts of myself, felt a kindness I had not known in years. I'll end with the poem that was placed second in this year's competition. Just to introduce the one of the lines in the poem was taken from the title of a book by Marie Howe, who's an American poet, and her entire collection is called What the Living Do. The Window, after Marie Howe. Once in a lifetime, you will gesture at an open window, tell the one who detests the queerness in you that dead daughters do not disappoint. Free your sore knees from inching towards a kind of reprieve. Declare yourself genderless as hawk or sparrow, an encumbered body let loose from its cage. You will refuse your mother's rage, her spit, her tongue heavy like the heaviest of stones. Your mother's anger is like the sun, which is like love, which is the easiest thing, even on the hardest of days. You will linger, knowing that the standing before an open window is what the living do, that they sometimes reconsider at the slightest touch of grace. Thank you.
They're still amazed, the surgeons who had to perform my little brother's autopsy, still stunned to one by one peel back the spine to find in each small cavity not marrow but a seal of salt and grit, the blood in its return not laying it, the residue still hot, but not leaving in the bone a single burn. They say he'd turn small fires in his sleep, that when he woke he'd hear just for a moment a crackling, that sudden hiss of magma dousing through the waves, the way the tide drags back to leave a mile of beach and sky still shifting overhead. A feeling he'd always gone back for, an emptiness I could not believe. I couldn't help but shake the cockles from my little brother's skin, or take out the gull's eggs from his throat he'd attempt each night to smuggle in. This was the first time I'd attempt with my own fists to beat the strangeness out of him. He wore then shadows deeper than the sea itself, and still he'd disappear for days, only to return changed, each time a little more estranged. He'd thrashed and bit and spat. There is no line between the sea and sky. Even if you throw away the key, it will still come. I left him shaking then in the dark, until his flesh had turned to moon and rust, his skin so thin you'd see each pebble of his spine, until one night I'd woke suddenly to hear waves knocking at his door, and from his cave not his small voice, but a harsher cry. I threw back the door to find the whole room blown to sand and sky, how as I'd slept he'd called the whole sea in. My little brother opened then like a prayer, to show there not muscle but a length of chain, and with each fist I felt in my own chest each blow come back. Where in our bodies do we store it, all that shame? How do we feel it as a knot, the gut all gone to rope, or how we sense only in our abdomen our loss? How when the surgeons took him out that last time to examine him, they'd said there was nothing in his throat. They'd said he'd choked of air itself. I knew the truth. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you to the Poetry Society, Judith and Ben, for organising the reading. And it's just such a massive honour to read with Mary Jean and other past amazing poets. Thank you very much for having me. I'd like to read three poems now, really. I've had this preoccupation, I think, for the last 4 years, which is really going to inform my first collection around the type of grief we inhabit in our bodies as a result of ecological damage to the environment, which is so amorphous and so almost uncontextualizable, if that's even a word, that we can't process it. And it just inhabits in our bodies and slowly starts to corrode. And these next three poems have really come from that space. The body's new weather. In waves it came, but waves so small at first, nobody noticed the leaves dropping all summer, or the landscape's frayed yellow edges, or the days we went without wind. Then winter packed up and didn't come back. Then again, the glaciers burnt dry, and the bears suddenly without their soft houses of snow. Then somebody shot them, and we thanked God for our climate's new harvest. But then we felt in our own bodies this new food rotting. Strange heat in the lungs, cancer ripening where the right meat should have been, and we named them our own illnesses, maladies of the body, not of the earth the body builds itself from. But then the earth turned on us, each new season collapsing until there was only high summer, and we felt then how the land must, aching and empty, and still we reached into ourselves, pulling up nothing, or rather not nothing, but another new desert, another woodland cut free from song. Only then did our bodies turn themselves on to protest like sirens in a city that has already been bombed. Snow country. Dawn over a white field. A fresh mantle of foot-deep snow and two greying silhouettes talking haltingly, moving haltingly against the tree line, against the coming light that brings for them a final throw at what, by now, is critical. 5 a.m. and I'm bolt upright, sweating, with someone else's pain in my chest. Outside, it's snowing again. The lake, packed with ice, makes the sound of metal under an approaching train, snapping, tensing as the body does. We stand on the moors and watch as the clouds fold in. Lightning opens the sky like a flung knife, and for a second it's visible again. Your contortionist's grimace, that mask of shock that holds, then falls as the snow does, unfurling from the sky like a flag. It's spring, but it could be autumn. We sit in the garden, under the leafless rowan, in the same place you first told me, only now the snow is smeared with mud. Standing, I half expect you, my mother, to keel right over. Carrying you back, I feel it, in the empty cup of my hand, your new weight. Grief, surely, is the loneliest animal. It hunts in the small hours, in the corridor between being alive and hearing you up again, rustling around the kitchen like a pile of dead leaves. Drinking in the calm of first light that, if translated, would read solace. Dusk over a white field, a smattering of new snow, and against the tree line, a blackening silhouette, walking around like a child, holding a hand that isn't there. Why I have chosen not to have children. No part of me wants to remember the first time I felt it, dipping hands into the hen house to find each bird a cinder, each egg still scalding hot, not yet hatched. Later, climbing fields to find cattle, birthing the huge black coals of their calves, alive at least until the last cow splits. Even our midwives with oven mitts cannot hold our infants' new fevers. Softly they sing, knowing something else burns through them, but the lymph in their limbs, I feel it too, but say nothing. Silence my only comfort, now I can hear drought knocking through the forest. Each birch, each branch, each blade of wood, a time sprung match. This is how we come to love, only what will not kindle. The flax mud and the estuary still feeding the sea. The soil I press into my lover's mouth, pleading. Now only the deaf, the eyeless stand and signal for weather. I have heard thunder shake out the whole sky and bear none, and to think we thought the boatman's song no warning, how we sold him all our rain, then cut him dumb. There's an amazing quote which I'd like to introduce the winning poem from this competition, this year's National Poetry Competition, with. It's from Bell Hooks, and I haven't got the quote with me, but I'd like to essentially paraphrase as a form of introduction. It talks about how men or boys a certain age essentially inflict small incisions upon each other, small fault lines, small traumas, which make violence, whether that's to themselves, to women, to other human beings, to an environment, more tolerable. So therefore, when the further acts happen, they're no longer felt as traumas within the body. And for me, that massively feeds into what the open field is about. Those traumas which make those acts of violence towards the environment palatable. Thank you for listening. And if anyone does have any tips on how to get the South Coast, that would be amazing. The open field. Six boys, a calf's tongue each, one task, to gulp each slick muscle down in turn, to swallow each vein whole and not give back a word, a sign, our mother's names, the scabs stripped off, the ritual learned, five boys step out across an empty field, five boys step out across an empty field to find a fire already made, the task to dock, then brand a single lamb. We learnt fast how to hold, then cut, then turn each tail away, to print in it our names, our ownership. We dock, we brand, give iron to the skin until at last its legs give. Four boys step out across an empty field, each small child waiting for a name, our own name to be called, the next task ours to own, ours to slice into, to shear off skin until we learnt the weight of it. One by one, we learnt the force our bodies hold, the subtle give our own hands have, how not to turn our gaze, three boys stand in a frozen field, each child stripped and hosed, the next task not to read the wind, but learn each name we have for snow, each name we have given to the world, to then unlearn ourselves, the self. This is the hardest task, to have nothing left, no thing but heat to give. Two boys step out across an empty field, still waiting for the call, waiting to become, waiting to dig, to turn at last our hands into the soil, the name the weakest as an offering, the field open to a grave, the last chore not to learn the ground, but taste it closed. I don't give back a word. Surprise I am the task, that what the land gives, it must then learn to turn back into soil. One child, a name, its task to steal. Five boys turn out from an empty field. Thank you.
I don't know if you know the harpy eagle. It's the largest eagle in the world, and it lives in the Amazon, and I've been lucky to see one a few times. Harpy eagle father. When I think of my father in the furnace, the gas jets aimed at his chest, fire wings budding from his shoulders, and his mouth opening with its lit interior, his tongue delicate as an icicle. I want to be a harpy eagle mother, feed dainties into his beak, its red gape wide open to the Amazon. I want to guard my precious snowflake, unsteady on his talons in the hot nest. I want to guide my chick as he inches onto a branch and shakes the blizzards of his wizard wings. Oh, take your time, I want to say, before the fledge. Perch here to watch the howler monkeys of this forest. Wait before you grow coverts grey as ash, your primaries lifting in violet air. Let the combustion chambers of your underwings pulse with maelstroms of white down. May the double halos of your body lift slowly and your head sprout its adult harpy crest before you're off, up, and through the trees, trailing a smoky wake. I think that was a very kind poem for my father. Mama Amazonica. Picture my mother as a baby, afloat on a water lily leaf, a name tag round her wrist, Victoria Amazonica. There are rapids ahead, the doctors call mania. For now, all is quiet. She's on a deep sleep cure. A sloth clings to the cecropia tree. A jaguar sniffs the bank. My mother on her green raft, its web of ribs, its underside of spines. I'll sing her a lullaby, tell her how her quilted crib has been known to support a carefully balanced adult. My newborn mama washed clean by the drugs, a caiman basking beside her. All around her, the other patients snore while her eyes open their mandorlas. Now my mother is turning into the flower. She's heating up. By nightfall, her bud opens its petals to release the heady scent of pineapple. How the jungle stories stir in the breeze from the window behind her. She hears the first roar of the howler monkey, then the harpy eagle's swoop, the crash through galleries of leaves, the sudden snatch, then the silence in the troop. Haloperidol, cenobarbital, they've tried them all, those witch doctors, and still she leaps up in her green nightie and fumbles to make tea, slopping the cup over her bed like the queen of rain. See her change from nightclub singer to giant bloom in the glow of the nightlight, a mezzo-soprano under the red moon. She's drawing the night-flying scarabs into the crucible of her mind. Over and over they land and burrow into her lace. By dawn, she closes her petals. All the next day, the beetles stay inside her. The males mount the females, their claws hooked round forewings. There is pollen to feed on, no need to leave their pension. Night after night, my mother replays this, how the white lily of her youth let that scarab of a man scuttle into her floral chamber before she could cry no. She flushes a deep carmine, too dirty to get up, and her face releases them. The petals of her cheeks spring open. Black beetles crawl out up the ward walls. One of the things that my mother did a lot of when she was in psychiatric hospitals was therapy, art therapy, in the day room. Serpentarium. She can fit a 30-foot giant into one sheet of A4, pack pythons into her sketchbook, squeezing their loops in tight breeding balls, until the man comes with his forked stick and pins her head down. She must have been drawing too fast, her tail in her mouth, like Ouroboros. That's what they call her when she goes crazy. Years ago, they sewed up her mouth. Now, a nurse comes to unstitch her. He nails her head on a hook, but that's just the beginning. She knows it gets worse. She thinks, if she can draw enough snakes, she'll get used to it, stop her eyes blinking when he shoves the hose down her throat, makes the room tilt. Water poured into her stomach, her jaws unhinged. Three of them holding her down to strap her arms to her chest while she thrashes against the memory, always the same memory, of the reptile she met that day on the Petit Pont, who insisted they go dancing, then escorted her to the hotel and seized her in his coils, who thrust his hemipenis into every orifice, murmuring how snake sex can take a whole night. Every scratch from his mating spur made her want to rip her skin off. Even when someone came in, he kept going, laughing at her. Years his eggs have stayed inside her, ready to hatch in this sketch pad. Cobras, cascabels, condors, tree boas, harlequins. She strokes the retic, her hog swallower. She fills in the last crosshatch on his snout, can feel the skin loosening around his mouth, ready for the molt. She waits for lights out, smudges carefully with the eraser, easing his skin like a dress pulled over a girl's head. The pencil of herself blunt, her work done, her own face empty on the pillow beside her. I'll end with a gentle poem. I've always tried to write a poem about what it was like to be inside my mother. And I haven't done that yet, but this is maybe what the surgeon saw. The Hummingbird Whisperer. Let the surgeon who opens my mother be tender as a hummingbird whisperer. Let him pull back the walls of her abdomen and see uncut jewels under his knife. Let him have a pet name for each part, his hummers, oiseau mouche, his beija flores, colibris, his almost extinct hooded visor bearer. Let him handle them with crystal instruments, easing droppers down each throat to check their stomach contents are rich in micro-insects and spider eggs, the nectar of never-before-seen orchids. Let him soothe them as their black eyes turn to watch him. Let them be so calm he can unwrap their dressings to measure their wings and wipe blood from their feathers. Let him clean each gorget and crest so the colours shine with health. Let my mother's dryads and sylphs, hermits and incas, her sapphires, her ruby topaz moustiques, practice flying again, forwards, backwards, on the spot, hovering and hyperactive to the last in their silk compartments. Let their dissolvable straitjackets drop off at the appointed time. Let the man who closes my mother's body check that each flight feather is intact and return her to the recovery room to land safely. Thank you.
Old summer. The small gnats mourn, and I am pregnant with the garden. I will bring forth mulberries. They wait to glow for the right weather to catch them. At a distance, they hide under leaves. Close up, they are detailed, engraved by someone like me, whose fingers might bleed, cross-hatching the memory of it. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Ledbury. Thank you, Poetry Society. And most of all, thank you to my amazing fellow poets for sharing the stage with me. The next poem is about pain, although that word is never mentioned, as if it's too scary to approach. And I speak of someone who has never really suffered acute or chronic pain. So the word's never mentioned. The title of the whole group is P, standing for pain. And in each of the small poems, pain is expressed as an analogy for something. So you'll find pain as a promise or a contract or a gift. P. Contract. Please, not the one a dog would be put down for, and not the one which is chronic, nor the one which is acute. Let it not be the one to demand its own journal, not the one between 7 and 10, or at 90%. Not the one I can point to with my finger, and even more, not the one I can't point to. Not the one I am asked to describe as black or red or is it white. Not the one with my own button to press, but not too often. Not the one which is postmodern. Not the one which is a needle, a hive, an iceberg, a volcano. Not the one high on heartbeat, skin conductance, and EEG. Not the one which is classic. Not the one which is earth, which is air, which is fire, which is water. Not the one where all the words and numbers live. Not the one with my face. Inheritance. The first body drew a safe nerve coat round itself, called it p, p, p. Promise.
One day I promised my body this was it. I would stay, put up with its little aches and trickles, twitches, gurgles, clicks. The noisy thing. It would be clean, well fed. I would buff its nails, part its hair, and keep it covered in public with soft fabrics, fluffy cottons, velvets, lamb's wool. Then my body opened its mouth, shouted, actually, said things I can't say. Then, after long silence, swallowed me whole. So now I am my body, nothing less, and this is me speaking. Task. It isn't hard, the job of breathing. It's not even hard to speak of breathing. And the insects and whirlers inside and all their spiky complicity in the day to day. Gift. You take the red box, pull ribbons which fall in waves and are not grateful. Moving on to more breath. This time it's city breath, and I must say it's lovely to be out of London in terms of what I'm breathing in today. Urban air. On the in-breath, it's made of gutter soup and small change gone particulate and burnt offerings. On the out-breath, leftovers from above and body heat and body moisture and even scraps of body outside itself at last, cells set free and on fire. I've always been a cartoon reader, and I think my obsession is partly to do with the speech bubble. I find it an intriguing space in the picture. And you know it has that little stalk that points to the mouth. And what has always really intrigued me is the gap between the mouth and the little stalk thing. What goes on there? I mean, what is that about? Almost a philosophical question. A bubble stem of grace. When I was a cartoon girl, with no breath, inside or out, I learned to dwell in the hiccup of white space between me and the pointed stalk of my speech bubble. How to push thought across that gap. Yes, that was the thing. How to be deft enough to keep the shape dynamic, to keep a burst of glint and shade in a sphere for a moment, a trace across a page. I'm going to finish with three little folk tales. These are the poems that are going to put me in prison, so please come and visit me. You'll remember how at the end of just the last century, many Eastern European poets used the folk tale as a way of telling their truths, particularly their political truths, in a kind of guise which wouldn't get them arrested. And this is my version of that. You'll see. Three folk tales from the Republic. One, out of her element. Ivanka polishes her trotters to make the 5-minute walk to the door of the tower. Once outside, she is carried over the cobblestones by her retinue, way above the ground, the dirt, the down there gravel, the big mess outside. Two. Daily life. Mornings, Ivanka blows her father, that is, she blows her father up into the messy balloon shapes he will inhabit all day. At midnight, he is vacuum-packed, flat, to push under the bed, her flat pack commodity, flat screen, tin thin mirror in which we see our own reflections and want to die. Ivanka's book. Ivanka's book is made of gold, a bit encrusted to tell the truth, with death, sweat, and exclusion twinkling along the foredge and the grain. The book's artifactual value is made of skin and body cells, long nerves of shot children, teeth of dissenters. It's a beauty. Open it, fall in, and never read again. Thank you.
So firstly, just thank you so much. I'd just really like to thank again our four readers. So Mary Jean Chan, Don Berry, Pascal Petit and Joe Shapcock. Thank you very much indeed for reading. Each of them read a poem also that has been one of the top winners in the National Poetry Competition, apart from Jo, who's saving hers. She's going to read right at the end. I wondered if we just might begin by just if you would tell us a little about the winning poem that you read or are about to read. Where did that poem come from, and where does that sit within the rest of your work? Mary Jean, are you happy to begin?
So I think we were talking about this earlier, how oftentimes we poets submit quite a bunch of poems to the National every year, and you have maybe one or two poems that you think might stand a better chance at maybe being longlisted or, you know, even shortlisted. And then there's always that poem that you put in the last minute because you think, oh, you know, it won't get you anywhere. And that's usually what ends up being chosen as a winning poem. So this was definitely the case for me. I thought The Window was actually quite a quiet poem, but the way it's kind of taken on a weight because of the winning has been quite strange for me. It was a poem I slipped in at the last minute. It was something I wrote for myself to process an experience that is still difficult to talk about outside of poetry. But I think what helped me write that poem was the words of other poets. So I mentioned Marie Howe, who's a very famous American poet, and she wrote an amazing book, which is an elegy to her younger brother who died. And the whole book's called What the Living Do. And I'm very, well, pleasantly surprised to know that she's at Ledbury this week as well. So she'll be reading on Sunday, and I'll definitely go and speak to her. And also the form of it, I do say, you know, which is like love, which is like everything. And that like comes from a poem by Alice Oswald called Wedding. And she says, you know, love, which is like a trick, which is like everything. So I kind of just found that the words of other poets have helped me piece something difficult together.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Jean. Yeah, just to echo what Mary Jean said about the type of poem or the unexpected nature of the one that won, I think. I sent maybe three off to the competition, and then I withdrew the open field from a bunch of other places before I sent it off, and I had no expectation that it would go anywhere, but just had like a feeling towards it. So I'd pulled it out from other places that I had it out and just threw it in as a wild card Sestina, which never wins the National Poetry Competition, right? I think to just touch on, I guess, about the poem itself, I kind of mentioned before I read the poem that bell hooks quote, and I think that is very seminal for me in terms of my understanding of the relationship between patriarchy and the environment, and the way in which we construct the world in a way in which it is purely an energy store, and out of that understanding of ownership, and that understanding of right to material from the earth, you get everything else as well, and the two are not inseparable. So that really was this poem was my first foray into that. I think maybe a couple of poems have touched upon or looking at that, and that will be probably my first collection. But I think that was kind of the first poem for me where I guess I felt like I managed to meld those themes together in that way. Yeah.
And Pascal, you were a judge this year, so you were one of the judges who decided that a sestina could indeed win the competition. What was it that stood out for you in that?
Oh, wow. I didn't actually realise it was a sestina the first time I read it. It was a poem that, you know, after you read it, you think, wow. And you kind of put it in the possible pile. And then you just can't get it out of your mind. So it was just kind of, you know, when I'd be gardening or whatever, it would come into my head and haunt me. And it is so, so dark. And I don't know. So it was long-listed and then short-listed, and, you know, and I realised the other two judges also thought it was fabulous. You know, it was just, I think, the poem that haunted the most, really. And once I kind of looked at the sestina aspect of it, I wasn't really so keen on sestinas, you know, because they do tend not to be done too well, the competition sestinas. But I just thought, oh, it's just amazingly done. And then there was, I think it was the last part. We kind of said, well, we're not sure if this is exactly the right kind of rule here that's been followed. And we all said, we do not care.
And I remember really vividly, I was in the room the year the judges chose your Harpy Eagle poem, and I remember their discussion so vividly, and them talking in the same way about the vividness of that poem. What's that poem like for you? Because that's now in a collection.
Yeah, that's in Fauvery now. I mightn't have put it in Fauvery if it hadn't got the commendation. But it's also, it was in 2012, I think, and I submitted a few poems, and that also was one that I just thought, oh, well, shove that in. They won't like that, but I'll shove it in anyway. And it actually was one of the first two poems that I wrote of Fauvery. It was my way into the book, and it came out of, actually, I have a novel on the, an autofiction novel on the back burner, and it came out of research for that. I was doing research in Paris, and I went to the Père Lachaise Cemetery, to the crematorium there, and found out all kinds of information. It is the only crematorium in Paris. I've never been to a funeral with someone cremated, so I wanted to really find out and have this fictional father cremated. And, of course, the harpy eagles that are one of the creatures that I'm obsessed with. And since then, I've actually seen them quite a lot in the forest. So it does feel a bit taboo, that poem, because... And I wondered what the judges would make of that, because I stick my... I'm in the actual, what do you call it, the furnace, imagining my father in there, and that just feels totally not done, really. So, I don't know.
Joe, so we were talking on the train about... sort of how does a poem change once it sort of has that extra spotlight on it of being a prize-winning poem? And that poem, Phrasebook, then became a title poem for you.
Yes.
of that collection.
So when I wrote Phrasebook, I was rather at the other end of a book than Pascal's experience. It was one of the final poems that was bringing a collection into kind of being embedded. And it was quite interesting. So before it won the competition, I showed it to my then editor. I was then with OUP. And she didn't like the poem, and she didn't want it in the collection. So I had to argue for it. I already thought I wanted it there. Just to give you some context, I'll read it later, but it's a poem about the first Iraq war, the 1991 war, and it really, it's about the experience of watching war on TV. It was like a computerized war, and the more terrible for that. And it incorporates phrases from the technology, the terrible technology of warfare, but also phrases from a phrase book, an Italian-English phrase book, though that doesn't matter. So it felt current to me, and I really wanted it in the book, and I would have liked it to be the title poem of the book, but I could only, with my editor, I could only argue to get it in the book, you know, somewhere where it didn't show much. And the book was going to be called something like Volumes. But then it won the competition, and even though it had gone into the catalogues with that name, I was able to make it the title poem. And I think that the publishers actually were quite keen to change it, because certainly at that time, where are we, 1991, they knew the competition would lift the book and do something important for it if it had that kind of recognition. For me, it was an artistic imperative, but that was the kind of push that helped me with the publisher.
And you not you, Joe, but you've spoken, the three of you, of it being a poem, of you submitting poems that you kind of put in as a, you know, as an also-ran. And that's something that poets often say to us, you know, oh, God, that poem, oh, my God. So I wondered, what are the poems that you choose to... What's your thought process about the poems you're choosing to submit that you think, this one, as you're writing, this one I might save and put in for a competition? What characterises them?
I think for me it just really comes down to intuition. You kind of get a sense over time of what your best poems are, or rather the ones that speak in a way which is perhaps most authentic to yourself. And I always try and do that rather than submit, I guess, a classic competition poem. And so far that's worked, which has been delightful. But yeah, so I think it's really just a case of feeling into it. And it does, like I'm unabashed to say, it does also come down to judges. I submitted The Open Field to this competition the year before, and I think I didn't get anywhere. So I think it does really come down to the judges, and you have to at least have an awareness of that as well to feel into that intuition of what kind of is working at that time for yourself, as well as the wild card, which sometimes you get weird feelings about as well.
I did hear somewhere, I don't know where I heard it, that, you know, couplets, like poems and couplets tend to be good competition poems. So I don't know. I just think, yeah, I agree with Dom. It needs to be poems that you're passionate about, and that sometimes I do withhold poems from, I don't know, sending them out to magazines. I just think maybe this one, I want to savor it. I want to keep it in, you know, in my computer for a bit longer and see what happens with it. And then you end up sending those out to poetry competitions. And the extra element of surprise of winning with this poem in particular is it's actually really short. It's actually almost a sonnet. It's very tiny. So I tend to think maybe longer poems, you know, you've got more room to say more. So maybe you tend to get further with those. But again, I was proven wrong. So I don't think I really know.
And how about from a judge's perspective?
Just before that, when I was entering, I used it for deadlines. I had no expectations whatsoever, but it was quite useful to have this deadline to finish something and polish it up and make it as good as it could be. It gave you that little extra push to get it ready. It kind of didn't matter what happened then, because it had pushed you in that direction. Later on, as a judge, I feel quite strongly about this notion of competition poems. I kind of don't believe that there is such a thing. I think, for me, I look for good poems. Also, I know that there are people who think they will write for those judges, or they will do something that they think is like a Pascal poem, and she will immediately give it first prize. And I really think that's not true, and that if anything, we're looking for something different, something with its own flavour, something that comes from somewhere you wouldn't expect, over the mountains, to really kind of shock its way out of the pile. So I think all the notions about what might be a competition poem, whether it's couplets or not sestinas or sestinas, put that out of your mind. Choose your very best poems and try to knock the socks off the judges. That's all I'd say.
Yeah, I think I've judged 6 competitions this year.
This year.
It's been really a fascinating process, and I think I've learned a lot from it, and it does make you very humble as a poet, because you realise, I realised that what I was looking for was something that would utterly surprise me and be something that I couldn't write, and that that, as Joe said, would shock me, really. It could be in a very quiet way, but something that would really surprise me, and that would make me think newly about what poetry is. And so if you're looking for that, you know, it also makes you go back to your own work and think, oh dear.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah, but, yeah. You know, we're sending 13,000 poems to judges. You know, I have this awful feeling when I'm ringing them up asking if there'll be judges that I'm about to ruin their lives. Do you have that? How is a year when you're judging loads and loads of competitions?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, there is a highly enjoyable aspect, which is that you're hunting for treasure. You know, you've got these boxes, especially the National Poetry Comp. You've got all these boxes. I don't know how many there were, 6 or 7 huge boxes. And you just don't know what's going to be there, you know. And that's very, very exciting, actually. But I have to say, also, it does take over your life. And I live in the depths of Cornwall, and on Christmas Day, yes, I was reading poems, yes. Yes, we had a power cut, and no, we had not yet eaten our Christmas dinner. But so I was reading poems by 10 candle lights.
That's dedication. That's wow. Amazing. I completely agree with that, that the treasure hunting aspect is a privilege, isn't it, really?
Yes.
But there's something else for me as well, that you... The volume of poems gives you a kind of extraordinary snapshot of what people are thinking about, sort of across the board, what things are concerning people this year in 2017, 2018, what's on their minds. So things come up that might be different the previous year or next year. And that's also a privilege, just to have this feeling that you're seeing inside the mind, the kind of group mind in some way. And you know, you come out sort of enlarged, or you know something new because of that.
So it's not just about the winning poems and picking those 10, it's about the inhabiting all of those.
Definitely.
Having that kind of insight into what's being written now, really, by...